From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, hauntings. Here's what's happening. 50 attorneys general are joining an investigation into Google over possible antitrust violations, according to the Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. The news confirms reports last week about the bipartisan investigation into Google's practices. The probe includes attorney generals from 48 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. California and Alabama are not involved in this probe. Other attorneys general at the media conference emphasized Google's dominance in the ad market and use of consumer data. So we'll see what happens there. Instagram could become the new breeding ground for disinformation in the lead-up to the 2020 election because bad actors are apparently adapting their tactics for the image-driven platform. According to a new report from New York University, deep fake videos, domestic disinformation, digital voter suppression, and Facebook-owned platforms like WhatsApp and Instagram pose the largest threats to the U.S., as the country looks ahead to the 2020 elections. Interesting. Days after U.S. Army Sergeant First Class Ellis Angel Barreto Ortez and 11 civilians were killed in a Kabul suicide bombing in Afghanistan, for which the Taliban claimed responsibility, President Donald Trump has now said that peace talks between the United States and the Taliban leaders are dead. We'll see what happens there. Overnight airstrikes targeted an Iranian base in eastern Syria. At least 21 people killed at the site, which was hit with 8 strikes. No word yet on who was the attacker, but it could have been us. The cost of health care in the United States is a controversial topic for many. And for many, health costs are at a serious source of stress, particularly with a slumping economy and potential for a recession on the horizon. Now, a recently conducted survey reveals some troubling truths about the impact of financial stress is having on an entire generation of Americans. According to a survey of 1,000 Americans aged 25 to 45, financial stress and worries are quite literally making people sick. Registered investment advisor Mish Sedlock on the line with us here. Hey, Mish, we've always been told stress kills, but I didn't know it affected young people this much.
Well, it's affecting a lot of people here, George, and it's really sad. Suicide rates among farmers are at the highest rates in like 30 years. Yes. People are committing suicide because they're stressed out of debt. Read an interesting story on the Wall Street Journal just the other day. It was talking about people trying to maintain their middle class status by going deeper and deeper in debt. George, if you can't afford what you're buying, it's all an illusion that you're really in the class you think you're at, don't you think?
A credit
report from the Fed came out today. Consumer credit up 11% month over month. This all fits into the picture of people tapping their credit cards, tapping their savings. And a third report came out yesterday that I talked about. It was regarding millennials buying homes. Now we're back to the category that you brought the subject up with. 75% of millennials who bought a home are regretting it because they forgot to take into consideration maintenance on things, the down payment, the interest rate, not being able to move. Stress everywhere, George.
It sure is, Mish. Thanks. We'll keep our eyes on that one. A Pennsylvania couple is facing felony charges of theft after their bank accidentally put $120,000 in their account, and then the couple spent most of it instead of trying to contact the bank. Robert and Tiffany Williams are also facing overdraft fees from the bank of $107,000, according to the criminal complaint. In an interview with law enforcement, Tiffany Williams said the money was spent on an SUV, a camper, 2 four-wheelers, and a car trailer, among other things. The bank error occurred May 31st when a customer in Georgia made a deposit of $120,000 and the bank teller entered a wrong account number. When the customer contacted the bank to ask about the missing deposit Investigators discovered the funds had gone into the Williams joint account. Jeez, what a mess. Well, you know, it is illegal to accept money from your bank if the bank puts it in your account by mistake. You can't spend the money. Chinese astronomers have detected repeated fast radio bursts, mysterious signals believed to be the source of about 3 billion light years from Earth, with the largest and most sensitive radio telescope ever built. An amazing story. Let's check in with Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky, for more stuff. What do you got, Stephen?
Hi there, George. Hey, as we move through September, really exciting things. Let's begin with space and talk about asteroids. The list of potentially hazardous asteroids, George, is now up to some 2,015 objects. These are objects that are probably larger than about 10 meters in diameter, and they pass within a distance of 4.6 million miles of the Earth. And just as you and the audience would want to know, we have two coming by us on September the 10th. The first is 2019 RG2. The second is a small asteroid known as 2019 QY4. I didn't make this stuff up. They'll pass the Earth by a safe distances of 2 lunar distances. Interesting stuff. But, George, I wanted to comment more on the story you just mentioned before, China's new FAST telescope. The acronym stands for the 500-meter aperture spherical radio telescope. Pretty hard to say, huh? It's detected, as you mentioned accurately, these fast radio bursts. What are they? Nobody really knows. Maybe they come from quasars. Maybe they come from black holes. But get a load of this, folks. The energy in just one of these millisecond bursts is coming out, these particular ones, in the 5 to 8 gigahertz frequency range, pretty high frequencies. But even more impressive, George, the energy in 1 millisecond burst is equivalent to all the energy the sun puts out, and get a load of this, in 80 years.
Wow.
What a mystery. We go to the live sky, George. Big stuff happening. This is the week for the beautiful and romantic, and emphasize that to everybody out there, the harvest moon. What is it in science? It's the closest of all the full moons to the autumnal equinox. This one, look on Friday evening, West Coast time, early into the morning hours of Saturday for the East Coast observers. But, George, it's quite fascinating. Another little bit of trivia. It'll be the smallest of all the full moons in the sky of 2019, some 12% smaller than the March moon. And don't forget, the planet Neptune, the farthest of the major planets, is now what we call opposition, George, meaning it rises when the sun sets. A little hard to see. If people have star charts, they can locate this and actually see it, even though moonlight might interfere, by a star in Aquarius known as Phi Aquarii. This particular planet, Neptune, 17 times the mass of the Earth, 14 moons, and of course, at a distance of 2.6 billion miles. How about this? It takes light 4 hours just to get from here all the way to Neptune. Dr. Sky reminds you to always remember to keep your eyes to the skies, of course. Email me at drskyshow@gmail.com. And another website that I think I can't get off of, I'm hooked on it, George. Everybody should check it. It's wikisky.org. You'll spend a lot of time there. And, George, I'm looking to see you and Tom this weekend in Scottsdale.
Can't wait. Tom, you'll be talking about that in about 15 minutes. Let's make a night of it, okay?
You bet, my friend.
Thanks. Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. In 2016... 46,000 people died from opioid overdoses in the United States. That number's even higher now. In a moment, Jonathan Emore joins us as we talk about this epidemic on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. In the late 1990s, pharmaceutical companies reassured the medical community that patients would not become addicted to opioid pain relievers, and healthcare providers began to provide them at greater rates. Increased prescription of opioid medications led to widespread misuse of both prescription and non-prescription opioids before it became really clear that these medications could indeed be highly addictive. About 130 people die from these opioid overdoses. Our guest tonight is Jonathan Emord. He's the principal of Emord & Associates. He practices constitutional and administrative law in Washington, D.C., before federal agencies. He's the only attorney in history who has defeated the FDA 7 times in federal court, 6 times on First Amendment grounds. Jonathan began his legal career as an attorney in the Mass Media Bureau of the FCC in 1985 during the Reagan administration. Here he is on Coast to Coast, Jonathan Emord. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, George. Good to be with you.
Well, just a few weeks ago, a court in Oklahoma ruled against opioid manufacturer and distributor Johnson & Johnson and hit them up with a $572 million fine for the first year. Oh, is that fair?
Well, I think it is. I think this is a really horrible crisis, not only because it's affecting so many people. Some 1.7 million people in the United States are addicted to opioids. But also because this is something that the drug industry and the FDA are largely responsible for. In 1995, Dr. Curtis Wright, the FDA medical review officer for Purdue Pharma's OxyContin, recommended approval of the drug in an expanded way for moderate to severe pain, and that opened the floodgates of the prescription crisis we now have. 2 years after he made that recommendation, Dr. Wright left the FDA to go to work for Purdue Pharma. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, it's just shameful. And even FDA Commissioner David Kessler admitted in a Clarion Ledger interview that it was no doubt a mistake. He said it was certainly one of the worst medical mistakes, a major mistake, he said, under his watch. So what we have here is a situation where prior to the mid-1990s, these pain-killing medications were largely limited to cancer patients. They were understood to be appropriate only for short-term use, even in cancer patients. And then in the mid-1990s, the FDA opened the floodgates by agreeing with Purdue Pharma that these drugs could be used for moderate to severe pain on a long-term basis. And then physicians, aware that the FDA had approved it in this way, began prescribing it. And the sales reps for Purdue Pharma and then ultimately for Johnson & Johnson and its subsidiaries and a whole host of pain-killing medication distributors began to have their reps go out to the doctors and tell them, hey, look, you're under-prescribing these drugs. They are not as addictive. In fact, there's very little chance. They even said 1% chance of addiction, that it's really a mistreatment of patients who have any pain not to give them these opioids. And so before you know it, the whole United States went from 1999, a statistic of overdoses of 4,030, to 47,600 in 2017. And whole states, cities and states, 41 of the 50 cities with the highest opioid use in four southeastern states, Kentucky, Alabama, Georgia, and Arkansas.
Why?
Well, it's because physicians, I think, were duped in large measure. So you have physicians all over the country prescribing these opioids for conditions other than cancer when pain is indicated, largely because the FDA had approved OxyContin. And then you have a whole series of opioids that are approved. And you have eight opioids now that are most commonly abused. And the physicians start to get, you know, the reality that this is happening, that addiction rates are going up and that people are dying. But by then, it really was too late. And a number of physicians began to engage in an illicit trade. They saw that the big pharma was getting away with it. And they thought, well, you know, I'm going to cash in. So they started to become pill pushers.
Jeez.
And this is horrendous. I mean, the cost to people. Individuals who are on opioids are almost induced to the point of death because they gain, if they start using it at a certain level, they no longer get a high at that level. They become acclimated to the drug. And so then they take ever higher levels until ultimately they overdose.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are mixing this with other things like anti-anxiety benzos.
That's right. And a lot of them start off on these prescription opioids and then shift to heroin because it's cheaper.
Where do they get the heroin? You can't get that at a drugstore.
Well, that's true. They get when they're so desperate for these painkillers and they can't afford them, then they just buy them in the illegal drug trade. I mean, fentanyl is pouring into the country from China, and that's in no small measure because Johnson & Johnson had this digestic drug, which was a fentanyl drug, and the abuse, you know, just a very small quantity of that drug can kill.
Oh my God! They just picked up some fentanyl a few weeks ago in I think a three-state area. That could have killed 14 million people.
Right.
14 million.
It is, you know, that's a synthetic drug made to mimic heroin, but to be hundreds and hundreds of times more potent than heroin. But this is, even in the midst of this crisis, FDA approved yet another opioid, even in the middle of the crisis, even while they were saying that, oh, there's this opioid crisis in the United States. And it's just it's just insane. And it was not until, even the FDA drug advisory committees, which had conflicts of interest, were agreeing that opioids were essential for pain management in the midst of this crisis. It was just last year that the Drug Advisory Committee on Opioids recommended approval of Dysuvia, which is a drug that is more potent than fentanyl, made by California pharmaceutical company AcelRx. And they recommended it for approval, and Dr. Scott Gottlieb, who was then the FDA commissioner and was making all these statements against the crisis, approved it. And he did that over the objection of several senators who sent him a letter saying this is, you know, that it's unacceptable behavior. That drug, Dysuvia, is 10 times more potent than fentanyl. Jeez. And 1,000 times more powerful than morphine.
And apparently legal then.
Oh. Right. FDA approved it.
Unbelievable. Where does Vicodin fit into this, Jonathan?
Vicodin is another opioid. And there's so many different brands of opioids out there, George, that it's extraordinary. I mean, there's no shortage of these drugs circulating.
I knew a guy who, a friend of ours in St. Louis, he died of a Vicodin Xantix overdose, Jonathan. We did everything we could to try to get him off this stuff, and apparently he was sneaking around.
Well, I can't, overestimate the addictive power of this. It's amazing that in this context of massive addiction, that you had drug companies running around telling physicians that these drugs aren't addictive.
Why would they say this? Don't they have any morality about themselves?
I guess not. I mean, what's shocking to me is the public trust in the FDA, such as it is, but that the FDA would protect people from this. You know, the FDA became complicit in this, and when you've got Dr. Curtis Wright not only approving it, despite the absence of any, zero, long-term safety evidence for safety and efficacy, no long-term safety evidence, he approves it for long-term use. And then in addition, he approves it for moderate to severe pain when previously the only evidence showing it being appropriate was in the context of severe cancer pain.
Whatever happened to the days when you would just take aspirin?
I know. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. I mean, why is it that we don't rely more heavily on those drugs? Frequently, not, even though they are not risk-free, but frequently non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are effective in reducing the inflammation that is the source of the medical pain and can be used instead of opioids. But it became in the late 90s and then on in through the up to about 2015, it became the drug of choice to give out opioids. A few questions were frequently asked. If someone was in pain, they were said to be under-treated if denied opioids by the drug reps and by the drug industry.
Mm-hmm.
With no limit. I mean, the FDA is watching this. They're getting adverse event reports. They're doing absolutely nothing until President Trump comes in and sounds the alarm. And until then, and even then, the focus was not initially on acting against the drug industry and acting against the over prescription. It was at the FDA, they have a post-market surveillance program. Every drug that's approved is supposedly monitored, and if there are adverse effects that arise, they're supposed to interdict those effects by taking actions.
Instantly.
And it's never worked. The FDA has always been the captive of the drug industry, and this is a real gross example. Here they are just presiding over death.
Hold on, Jonathan. We're at the break, but we'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jonathan Emord, our special guest, as we talk about opioids for the next hour and a half. We will take your phone calls next hour. If perhaps you have had a problem with opioids and you want to share that story with us, please do so. Otherwise, we'll just take your questions as well. And welcome back, Jonathan Emord with us, as we're talking about the opioid epidemic, which a lot of media, Jonathan, doesn't touch this subject either.
Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. That's because a lot of money comes from the pharmaceutical industry to pay for advertising on the media. And I think it's a subject that a lot of pharmaceutical companies really don't want to have aired these days. It's amazing how much money is made on this stuff. Just to give you an example, the king of the whole crew, Purdue Pharma, is wholly owned by the Sackler family of Connecticut. And they generated over $35 billion from the sale of OxyContin.
$35 billion?
Billion. And the family itself, in 2015, Forbes listed the Sackler family as among America's richest with a net worth of $14 billion. They edged out the Bushes, the Mellons, and the Rockefellers. So you see, this is big, big, big money. And that really, when they realize, you know, this is, they're profiting on an addiction. So they're ending up with massive amounts of money. The number of pills that are being dispensed are just phenomenal.
How much does this stuff cost? Like per pill, do you know?
Well, it depends because there's so many different varieties. But we're talking about hundreds of dollars.
A pill?
Yeah, depending on what it is, depending on the amount of the active ingredient present. When FDA approved this, we talked about the corruption there within the FDA. They first approved only 40 milligrams of OxyContin. Then they raised it to an 80-milligram approval. And then they finally raised it to 160-milligram approval.
That's huge.
And you know, the costs vary depending upon the quantitative amounts. But FDA Commissioner David Graham admitted, and I quote him, there is very little pharmaceutical use for an 80-milligram OxyContin. There's way too much drug in that tablet. So if there's no legitimate use even for an 80-milligram OxyContin, what are they doing approving 160-milligram?
That's crazy. That is crazy. Now, will Johnson & Johnson appeal this $572 billion decision?
Yes. So we have this decision from Judge Thad Balkman in Oklahoma, in the Oklahoma District Court of Cleveland County, and very well written decision under a very broad nuisance law in Oklahoma. And undoubtedly, Johnson & Johnson will appeal it. I think it's a good decision. I think that the argument against it, the arguments against it are rather weak. And I would fully expect it to be upheld on appeal.
Who were the plaintiffs, the state of Oklahoma or individuals in the state?
The state of Oklahoma versus, Johnson & Johnson, essentially, and its subsidiaries. And it was under one count, which was a public nuisance law count. And under Oklahoma law, unlawfully doing an act or omitting to perform a duty which annoys, injures, or endangers the comfort, repose, health, or safety of others is a public nuisance. That's unusual because most other states tie their nuisance laws to an effect on property, but not so in Oklahoma. And undoubtedly, when the appeal is filed, they're going to attack the law, probably because it's allegedly void for vagueness under the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, but it isn't. There's a clear standard here. The Johnson & Johnson lawyers are going to argue that, look, if this is allowed, then any company that sells an inherently risky product can be sued. So gun makers, oil and gas manufacturers, alcohol makers, whatever, are going to be able to be sued as a public nuisance.
And they should be if there's something wrong here.
Well, this is not just a situation of manufacturer, of course. The reason why we have this problem is not manufacturer. The reason we have this problem is that they went overboard in their promotions of this, making false representations, as the court found, where they alleged that there was very little chance of addiction and that the drugs were under-prescribed and should have been prescribed for moderate pain. In fact, all kinds of pain. And that recommendation, with the knowledge they had of the drug's effects and its risk of addiction, were false and misleading. So they went beyond mere manufacture. These are acts that satisfy the requirements of nuisance. So the difference between someone who makes oil and gas, for example, and Johnson & Johnson is immense, because the oil and gas companies don't promote the use of oil and gas for a use that would kill you.
Isn't Johnson & Johnson also involved in the talcum powder lawsuits?
Yes.
Mark.
Yeah. What we have here in this particular case, and I think Judge Balkman got it right very well, is a consistent campaign of promotion that is so outrageous because they were convincing physicians that it's okay against all the other information. They were telling them over and over again that it's okay. They published, they had the drug reps going in, they published publications that lied, even representing using scientific information they paid for that was false. They had educational programs at universities. They had videos. Purdue Pharma produced a video called I Got My Life Back. It was sent to 15,000 physicians, and it recommended opioids for people suffering from all kinds of chronic pain, and represented that less than 1% would be addicted. It's just over and over again the message was drummed into people. Not only that, they told physicians that if they don't prescribe it, they're really abusing their patients who have pain because of the low addiction rate. So they're hooking them in, and they're really working. They said that pain was undertreated. They said that the solution to undertreated pain is to increase opioid prescription. They said there's a low risk of abuse and a low danger associated with the abuse. They said that these opioids should be used for all manner of chronic pain and for non-malignant pain. So they're pushing it and pushing it and pushing it.
Jonathan, with this situation so out of control, why didn't they do the right thing and say low milligrams and do not prescribe more than one pill or two at the most a day? Why didn't they do that?
It is just an overwhelming greed. It's just greed. I mean, there's no question but that they're getting this information on addiction, and they're realizing. But you know, they didn't even train their drug reps on what to say about addiction, other than to say, "Oh well, largely, you know, addiction." They called it a phobia. They said, "When you think that there's addiction, really, it's just your reaction to it is ridiculous. It's, you have a phobia to this issue. This is not a problem." It's only 1%. It's very minimal amount of addiction that's happening out there. Yet you're going to deny all these people with pain relief because only a small percentage are addicted?
Of these 47,600 people who die per year with this overdose, how do they die? What happens to their body?
Well, when you talk about an opioid, you're talking about something that ultimately dulls the operation of every part of your body. So you're talking about heart attack, stroke, heart attack, and you're talking about organ failure. I mean, you're giving a substance that shuts down your body, slows everything down.
Is it sudden death, Jonathan, when it happens?
It's a painful death. It's a painful death until they're unconscious. I mean, you end up with this unconscious period. They're put into a coma state, and then they die. But on the way there, it's horrific. And I mean, one of the most horrible things in the world is to lose total agency, to lose total control, to be so obsessed about the necessity of something that it occupies every thought you have morning until night. And the agony that people go through as a part of that is a form of getting there to death. But it's a horrific way to go, boy.
Is it a breathing problem, too? Do they stop breathing that way, too?
Sure. Shuts down the respiration.
Jeez.
They use opioids to induce death, oftentimes illegally, but done humanely, for people with chronic or, you know, acute cancer that are in extreme pain, and they keep elevating the dose of the opioids until their respiration goes down. And they do that in a methodical way of slow increases until death to alleviate pain. And that is an accepted oncological method of saving someone from the extraordinary pain that can come in the latter stages near death of cancer. But when you're talking about an overdose, you're frequently talking about someone getting something at a higher level and undergoing a painful demise, because it's not in this clinical setting. They're not titrating it. They're just injecting it, forcing into their system an elevated quantitative amount because the last dose that they had didn't give them the high that they were interested in getting. So, I mean, it's a disgusting thing to have an industry that people expect will create drugs that will protect people, basically, to be in the business of profiting off of profligate use. In fact, they targeted those specialties that were most prone to abuse of these drugs, the pain management doctors, for example.
What happens next, Jonathan?
Well, I think there's going to be an appeal by Johnson & Johnson. I fully expect it. I expect that Johnson & Johnson will raise a host of arguments about the unorthodox use, the novel use of the law here. I think they are likely to lose, but we'll see.
Because there are other states involved in this too now, right?
Oh, yes. A whole host of other states. There's some 2,000 or more products liability suits, class action suits. They're inundated with litigation. The sad thing is, thus far, Purdue Pharma has gotten off the hook again and again. Even in this case in Oklahoma, there was a settlement by Purdue Pharma for a couple of $100 million in advance of the decision. So they're not a part of the case, and they've been paying a couple of $100 here and there, a couple of $100 million here and there, avoiding ultimate responsibility. No one's gone to jail. No, you know, and these people, when you're talking about
this could be criminal.
Over, yeah, they should be going to jail, of course, but they're being given a pass. And there's a lot of political power and control when you have that kind of money and you've had that kind of influence at the FDA for so long.
How could a pharmaceutical scientist, how could a chemist, those people that put these drugs together, how can they sleep at night knowing what they're doing?
Well, you really do have a question for the latest one, without a doubt. That would be in my mind that we talked about. But, you know, initially a lot of these scientists were really well-intentioned because they were trying to find methods by which you could relieve acute pain in cancer patients. It was the decision of Purdue Pharma to create this model of expansive use that would reach moderate to severe pain, and it was the decision of Curtis Wright at the FDA, and then ultimately the FDA itself, to approve that use, even though there was no sound scientific evidence, and they did nothing to assess the extent to which addiction seriously would occur if you expansively prescribe it. They knew, they could reasonably foresee, that there would be a tremendous increase in the prescriptions at FDA. Curtis Wright, Dr. Wright certainly knew that. 2 years later, he goes to work for Purdue Pharma. So you've got a real problem. Money is a huge incentive for people, and they frequently overlook these things. And, of course, they could excuse it to this extent. They say, well, you know, ultimately it's a doctor-patient relationship. This will be part of the appeal, no doubt, for Johnson & Johnson. That, look, we didn't give the drugs to the patients. We sold them to physicians.
And we put on the label, don't you take more than two pills or something. Maybe they did that.
Well, in the beginning, though, the FDA didn't label the drugs that way. They were complicit in this. They were talking about, even on the label, the low risk of
addiction
from legitimate medical uses. And they were talking about using it for moderate to severe pain. And they were all in on the underutilization of these drugs because of Dr. Wright at the FDA. So there's a cabal here, a government industry cabal that was designed to get these things out there and get them used more frequently. And then they began to see the consequences, and they were making so much money that not only did they simply turn and look askance, but they actively promoted the uses in the face of the ever-increasing numbers.
Were doctors receiving money for prescriptions?
Yes, and they were wined and dined, and to the extent that they were, you know, there are all sorts of things that were done by the drug industry to complement those who were big
prescription
prescribers.
Yeah. That's shocking. And what about the pharmaceutical drugstores that, you know, fill these prescriptions? Did at any point any of them say, hey, there's a problem here?
Well, they're kind of in a situation that's unenviable. They've got a prescription from a doctor that needs to be filled. They don't know.
And they want to make a sale.
They want to make a sale, of course, but they also are essentially, what is the basis for me as a pharmacist denying fulfillment of a prescription, right? But a lot of these places, I mean, really, when you're a physician and you see a patient returning before the prescription should be completed, and you see a patient asking for higher doses and so on, you've got to be on notice that there's a problem. But at the same time, the FDA was out there and the drug industry was out there with labeling information that suggested that you would be remiss if you didn't prescribe the drugs. And, of course, there are those physicians who just were a part and parcel of an illicit drug trade, effectively watching addicts come to their door and just pumping out the pills and making a fortune in the process of selling these things. But, this is a mess. The government has done a number of things to help. The Trump administration is pumping over $9 billion into the states through block grants to combat the effects. But we still have a broken FDA, and the next painkiller that comes along, chances are they'll approve it unless we put a moratorium on approval of these opioids, and we should.
Will these opioids go under, under the ladder, so to speak, where they become illegal and you buy them on the street?
Yeah, I think there's a risk of that happening. There's certainly the movement to heroin has been profound. Something like 80% of those on heroin said they began their addiction with prescription opioids.
80%?
80%.
That's crazy. Jonathan, we're going to take a break, but we're going to come back and take phone calls and questions for you next.